Well, good morning, everyone. Sometimes in life we face hard questions, don't we? Some hard questions are trick questions, such as what word is usually spelled incorrectly? Incorrectly. Incorrectly is the word that's usually spelled incorrectly. There are questions that rest on detailed knowledge. You know, what's the flight speed of an unladen swallow? That kind of question. Or there are questions like, why do the people who I love have to die? And they're just hard questions, aren't they? Tricky questions, trick questions, hard questions. Jesus faced some hard questions in today's reading. He faces three questions from three different groups of people. He gives three great answers. The first is the disciples of the Pharisees, and they join forces with the Herodians. And they're followed by the Sadducees. And then thirdly, the Pharisees have another go with a lawyer representing them. And the difficult questions they all ask are meant to trick Jesus and trap him and bamboozle him and stretch him. But actually the answers that he gives are better than the questions that they ask. They keep calling him teacher, and it turns out he's an amazing teacher. After the first question, the Pharisees and the Herodians are amazed and they leave him alone. After the second question, the crowd is astonished and the Sadducees are silenced. A much more senior person asks the third question, and it's less of a trap and more of a test. What does Jesus actually think about this? Now, in the storyline of Matthew's Gospel, Jesus has taught many times before, but now he's in Jerusalem. He's in the temple, he's in the spiritual, the intellectual heart of Israel. So this is the big test. And these are not softball questions. Last week, Jesus talked about the king's feast. He talked about the people who were supposed to come and who didn't take the opportunity and who are under judgment, and the other people who are invited in. Now, when you hear a story about people who are supposed to be God's friends but aren't, and there's a bunch of people like the Pharisees and the Herodians and the Sadducees who are supposed to be God's friends, they kind of see that as a bit of an attack on them, because it is. And so now they are attacking Jesus. But if Jesus can weather this storm, if he can pass these tests, then God's people should recognize his authority as a leader and a teacher. And for us, as we read, that pushes us, because we should let Jesus lead and teach us. We have lots to learn from him. What does he answer, and how does he answer? So let's start with what, because Jesus' answers tell us how to live. If I had to sum up each of Jesus' answers, three answers, in one line, I would say, give back to God. Give God's things to God. Life comes from God. And thirdly, give God your life. So first, give to God. The Pharisees and the Herodians come to Jesus together because they disagree. That's where the trap lies. Did you notice how they butted him up and they told him that he doesn't fear anybody, doesn't fear what they think? He says what he reckons. The Pharisees went out, they laid plans to trap him. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. Teacher, they said, we know you're a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by men because you pay no attention to what they say or who they are. Tell us then, what's your opinion? Is it right to pay tax to Caesar or not? Now, on one hand, plenty of Pharisees felt that the tax was not right, because they belonged to God. They didn't belong to some pagan king, so they shouldn't be paying a tax to him. And no one in the crowd wanted to hear that their taxes were right and fair. The way they got taxed was some standover man got them in a weak moment and threatened them unless they paid up. But on the other hand, the Herodians didn't really care about what was the popular opinion. They cared about power. And they kept their power for the family of King Herod by keeping the taxes flowing to Rome. So if Jesus says, yes, that's an unpopular opinion, But if he says no, he could get arrested for treason. Either way, this question is designed to trap him. Verse 18, but Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, "You hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin used for paying the tax." Jesus distinguishes between things that we owe to Caesar and other things that we owe to God. He acknowledged that certain things in the world come from and belong to certain people. Here's this coin that's got Caesar's face on it. It comes from Caesar's mint. It's protected, like all the rest of the empire, by Caesar's legions. And Jesus says, well, give back, repay to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. But in distinguishing and acknowledging and repaying, Jesus is also reserving a place for God. The gold comes from Caesar, but it's by God's will that that happens. It's not that the gold doesn't come from God, but even as we recognize that it comes from God, we can also recognize the earthly claims of governments. And there will be some things that we can only give to God, and we should give to God what is God's. So, all right, what are the things of God? Where has God put his portrait? What has God written his name on? What has come to us from God? Well, the next question and the next answer help us to think about this. Now, two key things about the Sadducees. First, they're the main party of the priests and Levites, the temple authorities. Second, they don't believe in the resurrection. They don't believe in the resurrection because they only accept the first five books of the Old Testament as scripture. And they don't have a lot of mention of resurrection explicitly. When you see the resurrection talked about in the Bible, in the Old Testament, explicitly, it's in places like Isaiah and Ezekiel, Daniel, so the sort of later prophets. So the Sadducees, look, we don't have resurrection, we don't believe it. Now, because they don't like resurrection, because they don't like prophets, they don't like Jesus. And because they're the temple authorities and they like the status quo, they don't like Jesus. So they come to Jesus with this highly technical, legal kind of question based on the Jewish law, which is supposed to demonstrate how ridiculous resurrection must be. Because all the people in this hypothetical are following the law, and yet you end up in this position where you go, well, whose wife will this poor woman be? She was married to all seven of them. Is she the first one's wife? Is she the last one's wife? Somewhere in the middle. How would you justify that she belongs to husband number four? Maybe she's married to all of them at once at the resurrection. Well, hang on. Is it really a perfect afterlife if, like, we've got polygamy? And like, what's going on? Come on, Jesus. Surely this is ridiculous, right? Maybe Jesus will say something against the law, and that'll make him an easy target. Or maybe he'll do a bad job. He'll say something against resurrection and he'll risk angering the crowd. See, that's the trap for the Sadducees. But Jesus doesn't abandon the law, nor does he abandon the rest of the Hebrew Bible. No, he says, now you are in error because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God. At the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven. But about the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what God said to you? I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He's not the God of the dead, but of the living. Now, what Jesus stresses here is God's role and God's power. When God raises the dead, who they were in relation to other people will be less important than who God is in relation to them. Being married is not important. Being eligible is not important. Our human categories of identity will become less important. That's part of what it means to be like the angels in heaven. And for Isaac and for Jacob, it's less important that they were Abraham's descendants. It's much more important that God chose to be their God and to bless them. So, how does this answer our earlier question? Well, the things of God The things that we get from God include our identity. Remember in Genesis, the important thing is not what we are, we're just made of dust. The important thing is who we are. We're made in the image of God. God has put his image on us. And so for the widow who gets raised up, the important thing is not her old life and her marriages. The important thing is her new life with God, from God. And so the things we have from God are our human dignity and our identity and our blessings and our life. So we've learnt we have to give back to God the things that come from him. And we've learnt that our life comes from God. So we put those two facts together. What do we get? Well, give God your life. That brings us on to verse 37, the greatest commandment. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. That is a very broad commandment, isn't it? Or put God's good at the centre, that's love, put God's good at the centre of everything that you've got, heart and soul and mind. Whatever you're doing, whatever you're choosing, whatever you're thinking, however you're living, the you doing those things is to love God. Do those things in the way that pleases God and that serves him. And as Jesus says, the second commandment is like it. Our neighbours also have dignity and personality and life as gifts from God. If we love God and if he's put his image on them, then we ought to love them too. The rest of the law and the prophets, says Jesus, the whole thing hangs on those two commands. They're all about loving God and loving our neighbour. So that's what Jesus answers. It gives us a lot to live by and a lot to follow. No matter how, who our earthly kings are or who our rulers are, we're to love God with everything that we have. Now, when we're being godly and loving God with everything we've got, that can seem a bit like abandoning the world and spending all of our time on contemplation and on worship, can't it? The church has a bit of a reputation, a bit of a history of coming across to outsiders as being a bit weird, a bit strange, a bit not unworldly. But because Jesus says all, that can't really be how it works. I can't serve God with an hour on Sunday morning and maybe 10 minutes before bed. I go, yes, I love God with some of my heart and soul and mind. I can't serve God with some of my life or even most of my life. Because at some point I'm going to need to eat and sleep and wash and cook and work and play because I'm human and I live in the world that God's made and he's put us in. Now if I have to do all of those things and yet I'm called on to love God with all of my heart and soul and mind, well, then I need to love God with all that I am while I eat and sleep and wash and cook and play and work. And so loving God doesn't take us out of the world, it keeps us in the world. And our love for God doesn't take us away from other people because they too are in God's image. They represent God to us. They are God's and not ours to judge. And so we want to love them. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. That means that all of the different things that God calls on us to do are all about us loving him and loving other people. Now that gives us a clue about the how Jesus answers these three hard questions. Why can Jesus answer these questions like this? Well, first, he actually lives for God. That's why he can answer like this. Because he lives for God, he's not threatened by lawfulness. Questions about legals. Second, Jesus believes in God's power and God's promises. And so he believes in the resurrection. He's not bothered by the Sadducees' question. And finally, Jesus treats the law as something that's all tied together by God's will. So he doesn't get trapped into reading one command against another one. First, Jesus actually lives for God. The power of questions of legality is not just that no one wants to be on the wrong side of the law. The sting comes because we do want some of the things that the law has ruled out. Let me give you an example. For a lot of us, the speed on the road that we drive is a compromise between our desire to get somewhere as quickly as possible, okay, but the law has kind of ruled that out. But there's this sort of likelihood that we'll get caught. So the higher the likelihood, the lower the speed we'll do, the more we'll kind of err on the side of the law. But gee, we'd really like to be able to go faster. The legality of donations to charity is not a big thing that we argue about in our society, but sometimes the legality of whether or not you can claim a tax deduction on that, that is a big issue. We don't, you know, we're not that fussed about whether you give to charity or not, but oh, actually, I'd like to get some of my tax dollars back. That's where the sting is, because we want some of those things that have been ruled out by the law. Now, I don't mean as Christians, I mean this is kind of how people think. We want what's on the wrong side of the law, but we want to stay on the right side. Some of us are more scrupulous than others. We like to stick really close to the law, and the reward for that is you get to look down your nose at the people who are a bit on the other side. But Jesus actually lives for God. Jesus knows that he loves God with all of his heart. And so he's not bothered by questions of legalism. He doesn't need to avoid getting into trouble. He doesn't need to demonstrate that he's a good person because he is the good person. He's not saying, gee, I wish I could do more, but realistically, here's where I land. No, he could not do more. And so if we want to be able to cope with questions of, well, what's allowed and where do you land and is this okay or is that not okay, we need to be people who follow Jesus. Now, I've just said in order to be able to answer niggly questions, we need to love God with all of our heart and soul and mind. That's a fairly big ask. That's a fairly heavy cost to pay just in order to be able to field a few questions. We're actually setting ourselves up to fail when we want to follow Jesus because Jesus loved God with all of his heart and soul and mind, and we can't. So we can be honest about how high his standards are. And we also need to be honest about how frequently we will fail them. But we can be honest because Jesus graciously welcomes us back and restores us to himself. So Jesus lives for God. Second, Jesus believes in God's power and God's promises. Jesus believes that God is powerful, that God is able to do the things that he says. Jesus believes that God is a God who speaks. And so he reads the Old Testament, he says, here is God speaking. And so where there is a question, which, well, gee, that's a bit complicated, I'm not quite sure. When you put the law together with the promise of resurrection, well, what would that mean for this woman's case? Jesus doesn't say, I don't know, presumably because he's the Son of God and he does know. But I think that frees us up to say, I don't know. I believe in God's power. I believe he's able to do this. I can't see how he could do that. But then I'm not God. I'm not the powerful one. Jesus believes in God's power. And so he's able to believe God's promises. And so he can believe in resurrection. And Jesus treats the Old Testament, he treats the law, he treats all of God's word as held together, unified by God's will. It's not just a whole series of little customs and commands and, yeah, do this sometimes, do that other times. Oh, yeah, when those two things clash, what do you do? Well, actually, says Jesus, they won't clash because they're aimed at love. Love for God and love for people. And if you're using them in a way that means that that doesn't work, then, well, you're living by the rules wrong. The great command is to love God with everything you've got. And the second great command is to love your neighbor as yourself. And if you're doing those two things, that will explain to you how to apply this law or how when this law is valid. Or how to take principles from those laws and how to think them through into life in Mortdale in 2023. Jesus sees the law as an expression of God's will. And he knows that God's will for our lives is holy and pleasing and perfect and good. And so he doesn't get trapped into reading one law against another. So, to recap, from Jesus' answers, we learn that we should repay God what we get from him. And what we get from him is our life and our identity and our humanity. And so we should give our life, heart and soul and mind, back to God. And from the way that Jesus answers, we learn that we need to be people who live for God and not just for his rules. We need to know and learn and remember God's will for our lives. And we need to be people who believe in God's power to save us and his promise to save us by his King. Amen.